Well, Matt, and welcome to episode 114, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for October the 18th, 2015. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings, this is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast we kick off our two-month-long discussion of Measure for Measure with an introduction to the play and a plot synopsis. Now, on a first reading, I really like Measure for Measure. Now, I can see why many don't like it. Cynical worldview, no truly likable main characters, foul sexuality, bad government. Yeah, I know, it sounds bad. Horrible, really. So what do I like about it? You mean, aside from all of the above? Well, how about wonderfully complex characters in your trio of the Duke, Angelo, and Isabella? Body humor. Laugh-out-loud moments in just the reading of it. Great social commentary. Ridiculous situations. I mean, come on, another bed trick that pushed the play to the breaking point. In fact, some critics, like Harold Bloom, have said that Measure for Measure did break comedies for Shakespeare. He never wrote another pure comedy, light or dark, after this one. From here, canon-wise, we descend into tragedy and then get lifted out of those by the romances or tragicomedies. Or maybe it's just that I see so many possibilities as to staging. I mean, you could play this dark and solemn or wild and comic. You could set it in the Renaissance. You could set it today. Maybe that's what it is for me. I see this as an incredible piece for today in America. It's just this incredibly timely piece. Now, will I still feel this way when we're done in a month and a half? Who knows? But we're going to find out. So, now let's take a look at the plot. As Measure for Measure opens, we're in Vienna, where Duke Vincenzio is discussing his impending absence with an aged lord and advisor, Aeschylus. We learn that the Duke is planning to leave the government of the city to a deputy, Angelo. The Duke asks the lord, "What figure of us think you he will bear?" Aeschylus responds that, "If any in Vienna be of worth to undergo such an ample grace and honor, it is Lord Angelo." When Angelo enters, the Duke concurs with Aeschylus, saying, "There is a kind of character in Angelo's life, a virtue that needs to go forth from him into the world." The Duke tells Angelo, "In our remove, be thou at full ourself. Mortality and mercy in Vienna live in thy tongue and heart. Old Aeschylus, though first in question, is thy secondary." Angelo is to be the Duke's substitute, but the Duke warns that while Angelo can take a man's life by words, the actions of his tongue, mercy needs to live in his heart. Aeschylus, even though he is of a higher rank, will become Angelo's deputy. And at this point, I've got to wonder why then Angelo is given the job. Angelo shares that doubt, asking that more tests be made of his mettle before he be given such power. The Duke will hear nothing of it, however, and tells him that while the Duke will write to Angelo occasionally to tell him how it goes with the Duke, he is leaving immediately, so quickly that he's not even making his exit public, saying, "I love the people, but do not like to stage me to their eyes. Though it do well, I do not relish it well, their loud applause and aves vehement." He loves the people, and it seems that they love him in return, so much so that a man of safe discretion should be wary of it. Once the Duke exits, Aeschylus asks to have a discussion with Angelo as to the limits of his power, and by extension Angelo's. Angelo agrees, and the scene ends. In Act 1, Scene 2, we've gone from the corridors of power to the public streets where we meet some gentlemen and Lucio, described in the character listing as a fantastic or one who has fanciful ideas or indulges in wild notions, according to the Oxford English Dictionary Online. Lucio's conversation bounces around. Pirates, foreshadowing alert, the Ten Commandments, soldiers, grace, religion, and velvet. All of this is on his path to bodiness, complete with allusions to venereal disease. The trip to Bodyville is complete with the entrance of a bawd, or a brothel madam, the wonderfully named Mistress Overdone. As Lucio and the gentlemen continue to speak of diseases, Mistress Overdone tells them that there's one man yonder arrested and carried to prison who is better than any of them. Meet Claudio. We learn that this man is not only being taken to prison, but that within these 3 days, his head is to be chopped off. His crime? Getting Madame Giulietta with child. At this point, the gentlemen talk of the recent speeches and proclamations. It seems that these kinds of arrests have only recently begun taking place. Might this be the result of our new deputy duke? As Lucio and the gentlemen go to see Claudio, Pompey, a clown, theatrical term, not his job, he is actually, we shall learn, a tapster for Overdone, enters with more information. All the houses of prostitution in the suburbs of Vienna must be plucked down. Of course, this is bad news for Overdone. Upon her and Pompey's exit, Lucio and the gentlemen re-enter, now escorting Claudio, the provost taking him to jail, as well as some officers and Giulietta. Prison is bad enough, but Claudio complains that he's being paraded through the streets on his way to the prison, only to be told that this shaming comes from Lord Angelo by special charge. When Lucio speaks to Claudio, we get more background information. Giulietta and Claudio were engaged. She is Fast Claudio's wife. But their wedding had been delayed because of the dower was not yet ready. But now, with Giulietta visibly pregnant, character too gross writ on Juliet, it's obvious that Claudio is guilty and is being punished for the crime of fornication, a law that had not been enforced in nearly 2 decades, 19 zodiacs, but a law that the new deputy is now executing. This is pitiable, and Claudio asks if Lucio will go to the cloister where Claudio's sister is about to enter the sisterhood and convince her to beg mercy from the strict deputy. And with a sense of urgency, the second scene ends. The third scene of the opening act takes us to a friar's cell in Vienna, where Duke Vincenzo and Friar Thomas enter in the midst of a conversation. The Duke talks of the strict statutes and most biting laws that he has let slip, and into Angelo's hands he has left them. The Duke doesn't want to seem too dreadful in executing the law, leaving it for Angelo. But it seems that he's having some misgivings, and asks the friar to supply the Duke with a habit of a true friar so that he may behold Angelo's sway. Though he believes Angelo is precise, the Duke does say, "Hence shall we see if power change purpose, what our seemers be." In the fourth and final scene of the first act, we are taken to the cloister where Isabella, Claudio's sister, is about to enter into the sisterhood. Like Angelo in the first scene, she wonders on the limits of her privileges. Not because she feels that she would be given too few rights, but rather she wants a more strict restraint. When Claudio arrives, we get an idea of what those restraints are. Once she is in the sisterhood, she is told that she will only be able to speak to men if her face is hidden, or if she shows her face, she must not speak. Lucio delivers the sad news of Claudio's situation and tells her, "All hope is gone unless you have the grace by your fair prayer to soften Angelo. And that's my pith of business twixt you and your poor brother." She agrees, and we end the first act of Measure for Measure with the plot in place. A brother endangered, a deputy harsh, a sister to the rescue, and an absent duke watching it all. When Act Two begins, we're back to our men of power, the deputized Duke Angelo and his lieutenant Aeschylus. The first of the act's four scenes opens with a philosophical debate between the two men, regarding the purpose of laws and punishment. Angelo argues that we must not make a scarecrow of the law, letting it just stand there until the birds of prey treat it like their perch and not their terror. Aeschylus, on the other hand, looks for the law to be more surgical, keen, and rather cut a little. Aeschylus argues on behalf of an unnamed, at this point, party who had a noble father. Before a speech is done, it's obvious that this line of argument isn't working because Aeschylus changes tack and asks Angelo to look at the case differently, as if he had not sometime in his life erred in the point which he now censures the man in question. Angelo's response is first to allow that the jury passing on the prisoner's life may, in the sworn 12, have a thief or two guiltier than him they try, but then to say that if he were as guilty as this man, let mine own judgment pattern out my death, and nothing come impartial. He reiterates the man's sentence, and we learn that this man, Claudio, will be executed by 9 tomorrow morning. Into this philosophical discourse come new arguments in the form of Elbow the Constable, Froth the Foolish Gentleman, and Pompey the Clown. What follows is a sequence that feels a bit like a retread of Much Ado About Nothing's Dogberry interrogation scene, especially with Elbow's confusion of words. Only here, Elbow has brought Froth and Pompey forth into court to try them for more sexually based offenses, especially those against Elbow's wife. Angelo's patience is tested, however, and he departs, hoping Aeschylus will find good cause to whip them all. The scene continues in its verbal humor, with Aeschylus reiterating to Pompey that prostitution will end in Vienna. Pompey wonders if they mean to geld and splay all the youth of the city. When Aeschylus says no, the tapster says that it won't matter if the brothels are torn down, the youth will to it then. Aeschylus warns that there are pretty orders beginning that will bring the beheadings and hangings. Pompey explains that how this will be bad for the economy, and that within 10 years they'll be allowing prostitution again just to increase the population of Vienna. Aeschylus then sends them off with a warning that if they ever appear in his court again, he will have them whipped. On the plus side, this is better than the death that Claudio faces, and a death that grieves Aeschylus. In Act 2, Scene 2, we're back to Angelo in his office as he reiterates to the provost that Claudio must die the next day. Lucio and Isabella arrive to plead for mercy, and what follows is her fairly convincing, to the reader at least, arguments for pity, Lucio's semi-comic asides to spur on Isabella, and Angelo's cold response. Isabella states, "Oh, it is excellent to have a giant's strength, but it is tyrannous to use it like a giant." At this point, something interesting happens in the scene. Angelo stops responding. For almost 40 lines, Angelo says nothing save to ask why she's continuing. Then, in an aside, he says, "She speaks, and 'tis such sense that my sense breeds with it." And don't think that the verb breeds isn't telling. He sends her away, and then, like Olivia to Viola / Cesario in Twelfth Night, asks that she return tomorrow. When she and Lucio leave, however, Angelo is in turmoil. Alone, he desires her foully for those things that make her good. He wonders, does he love her that he desires to hear her speak again and feast upon her eyes? Isabella, this virtuous maid subdues him quite. In the third short scene, Duke Vincenzio, now in the guise of a friar, visits the prison to minister to the prisoners accordingly. He meets Giulietta and learns of her love with Claudio and their sin mutually committed. If a friar's job is to bring comfort, the Duke hasn't gotten that part of the job down yet. He tells Giulietta that Claudio must die tomorrow and leaves her lamenting a life whose very comfort is still a dying horror. The fourth and final scene of the second act takes us back to Angelo's office, where we learn that the intervening time has been filled by Angelo with praying and thinking. He has sent empty words to heaven, but his mind anchors on Isabel. Now, if this was the ending of a fun comedy, he would reveal his love to Isabel by freeing her brother. She had fallen in love with him, and cue weddings overseen by our disguised Duke. But this isn't the end of a fun comedy, but rather the rising action of a so-called dark comedy. So prayer and thoughts have given way to more physical desires. Blood, Angelo laments, thou art blood. Enter Isabella. She's come to know if Angelo has changed his mind. The deputy answers, your brother cannot live. And yet, he also says that while Claudio must die, he may live a while, and it may be as long as either Isabella or Angelo. She's confused, and Angelo is less than helpful bemoaning these filthy vices. Finally, in a moment when Shakespeare seems to invent the would-you-rather game, Angelo says, then I shall pose you quickly. Which had you rather, that the most just law now took your brother's life, or to redeem him, give up your body to such sweet uncleanness as she that he hath stained? He even couches the offer as a charity in sin, but Isabella sees this only in terms of damnation and souls, saying that if asking for mercy were a sin, heaven would allow it for Isabella. If pardoning her brother is a sin, then she will pray for Angelo every morning. It's obvious that she isn't quite getting the picture, as he tells her, your sense pursues not mine. Either you are ignorant or seem so, crafty, and that's not good. When it's clear that her mind simply doesn't work the way his does, he becomes more blunt. Admit no other way to save his life, but that either you must lay down the treasures of your body to this supposed, or else let him suffer. What would you do? So bluntly put, she finally understands, and chooses death for her brother before she'd yield her body up to shame. Angelo takes another tack, saying that if she's a woman, she should show it now by putting on the destined livery of sexual service for her, or in this case, any man. When this doesn't work, he professes, "I love you." Isabella then goes on the offensive, threatening, "I will proclaim thee, Angelo. Look for it. Sign me a present pardon for my brother, or with an outstretched throat, I will tell the world aloud what man thou art." And it is now that Angelo drops the bomb that was a bomb then and is still a bomb today. Who will believe thee, Isabel? In a page torn straight out of the sexual harasser's and date rapist's playbook, he states that his unsoiled name will so her accusation outweigh that she will seem like the guilty party. If we had any grain of sympathy for the conflicted Angelo, it's gone. Especially when he now says that unless she give in to his sharp appetite, not only will her brother die, but his death will draw out to lingering sufferance, in other words, torture. He leaves her with one last gloat. As for you, say what you can, my false or ways your true. The scene and act end with Isabella coming to the realization Angelo and all of his ilk want her to. To whom should I complain? Who would believe me? She leaves us, knowing that all she can do now is go to her brother and fit his mind to death for his soul's rest. As Act 3 begins, we're in the prison as the true Duke, now disguised as a friar, meets with the doomed man and is taking what I suppose should be a confession. I say should be because it's less a listening to and a whole lot more like a talking at. The Duke, I almost want to call him Frook to mix his friar disguise and his Duke identity, spends nearly 40 lines advising Claudio to be absolute for death. Either death or life shall thereby be the sweeter, concluding that in this life lie hid more thousands death, yet death we fear that makes these odds all even. The argument works for all intents and purposes, and Claudio seems as if he is ready for death. Enter Isabella. When the Frook, okay, I'm going with it, learns that the visitor is Claudio's sister, he asks the provost if he might listen to the siblings speak. This agreed, the two withdraw. When Claudio asks what comfort she brings him, she coolly outlines Claudio's comfort in the heaven to which Angelo is about to send her brother as his swift ambassador. When Claudio asks if there is any remedy, Isabella only says that there is, but to save a head, to cleave a heart in twain. Will free your life, but fetter you till death. Perpetual durance of restraint through all the world's vestidity you had. Bark your honor from the trunk you bear and leave you naked. All the while, Claudio asks what that remedy might be. When she finally tells him, if I would yield him my virginity, thou mightst be free, he responds, as I'm sure both the Frook and Isabella would hope, as a man prepared for death. O heavens, it cannot be, thou shalt not do it. She tells him that if it were but her life, she'd throw it down for his deliverance, as frankly as a pin. Claudio is astounded by the deputy's request, and he tries to work out how this can make Angelo bite the law by the nose. It makes no sense to Claudio. Why would the prenzi or precise Angelo make such a request, unless it is no sin, or of the deadly seven, it is the least? He muses about why would Angelo, for the momentary trick, be perdurably fined, punished forever, even after death? And this gets him thinking about his own death, and any comfort and resolution that the Frook had brought him is tossed out the window. 'Tis too horrible, he concludes, and then begs, sweet sister, let me live. What sin you do to save a brother's life, nature dispenses with the deed so far that it becomes a virtue. Nature will forgive Isabella, he pleads, if she does this to spare his life. This does not go over well. Calling him beast, faithless coward, dishonest wretch, in just over the course of two lines, she leaves him, saying, I'll pray 1,000 prayers for thy death, no word to save thee. She won't even listen to his pleas for her to listen. She wants to go. She's stopped by the Frook, however, who tells her he can help and then tells Angelo in an aside not to worry about Angelo, as only he hath made an assay of her virtue to practice his judgment with the disposition of natures. Yeah, right. Regardless, he tells Claudio to prepare for death, then speaks with Isabella, telling her that he had overheard what she had told her brother. She laments that the Duke had left Angelo in charge and wishes for his return so she can tell him. In response, the Frook says, I do make myself believe that you may most uprighteously do a poor wronged lady a merited benefit. Redeem your brother from the angry law. Do no stain to your own gracious person, and much please the absent Duke, if peradventure he shall ever return, to have hearing of this business. When she agrees, the Frook, tells her the tale of one Mariana, the sister of a soldier, Ferdinand, who died at sea. Well, it seems that good old Angelo had been betrothed to Mariana, but when Ferdinand's boat sank, not only was Ferdinand killed, but the dowry lost as well. Of course, my question is, did the Duke know all this before? And if so, why did he still leave that douchebag as his deputy? Without the dowry, Angelo called off the wedding, left her in tears, and dried not one of them with his comfort. Angelo, according to the Frook, a marble to her tears, is washed with them, but relents not. And Isabella, the Frook says, can help right these wrongs. And what's the Frook's plan? Go you to Angelo, answer his requiring with a plausible obedience, agree with his demands to the point, only refer yourself to this advantage. First, that your stay with him may not be long, that the time may have all shadow and silence in it, and the place answer to convenience. This being granted in course, and now follows all, we shall advise this wronged maid to stead up your appointment, go in your place. If the encounter acknowledge itself hereafter, it may compel him to her recompense. And here, by this, is your brother saved, your honor untainted, the poor Mariana advantaged, and the corrupt deputy scaled. That's one heck of a plan. And completely original, too. Oh, wait. Isn't this plot just a little like the one in our last play, All's Well That Ends Well, with that wacky bed trick? Yeah. Regardless, Isabel agrees, and the Frook says that he will head off to the moated grange where resides this dejected Mariana. And Isabella exits while the constable Elbo and the clown Pompey enter. The Frook asks what offense Pompey has done. He hath offended the law, Elbo says, and this is enough for the Frook to chastise the clown for being a bawd, a wicked bawd. When the Frook says that Pompey must be taken to prison, he sounds like nothing more than Angelo. Pompey attempts to get help from Lucio when he enters, but the Fantastic does nothing more than make jokes at Pompey's expense, and to tell him, I sent thee hither to prison, for debt, Pompey. Great friend, that Lucio. After Elbo and Pompey exit, we get a most unusual conversation between Lucio and the Frook. Lucio laments the mad, fantastical trick of the Duke to leave Vienna. Some rightful Angelo bashing by Lucio follows, but then he turns his verbal onslaught to the absent Duke, whom Lucio claims had some feeling of the sport. He knew the service of prostitution. When the Frook comes to the Duke's defense, Lucio doubles down on his portrait of the Duke, saying he would be drunk too, implying Lucio knows this because he was an inward or confidant of the Duke's. The Frook tells Lucio if the Duke ever returns, the Frook will reveal to the Duke what Lucio has said. Lucio is nonplussed, proclaiming, Sir, my name is Lucio, well known to the Duke. And you can feel another domino being put into place. When the subject turns to Claudio, Lucio repeats his sadness over the Duke's absence, as he would have spared Claudio, and Lucio leaves the scene. Before the Frook can leave the stage, however, he is met with the provost, Aeschylus, and a new prisoner, the bawd Mistress Overdone, who claims that it's Lucio's information against her that sends her to prison. Aeschylus recognizes the name of a fellow of much license and says that Lucio should be brought before the court. The officers take Overdone away, leaving the Frook and Aeschylus free to discuss the world and justice. When the Frook inquires over the absent Duke's disposition, Aeschylus describes a man who is given to the pleasure of rejoicing to see another man marry more than marry at anything which professed to make him rejoice. In other words, a good man in Aeschylus's estimation. They speak of Claudio, and Aeschylus explains how he has argued for mercy, in this case, to no avail. As he says, "My brother Justus have I found so severe that he hath forced me to tell him that he is indeed Justus." It's obvious that Aeschylus has more positive feelings for the absent Duke. Aeschylus leaves, and the Fruc ends the third act with a soliloquy, criticizing Angelo, twice treble shame on Angelo, and recapping his plan to bring him down. In the sixth scene, Act 4, the plan is put into motion, but that doesn't mean things go as planned. The act begins at the moated grange where resides this dejected Mariana, where she sits listening to a boy sing about unrequited love. When she sees the Fruc approach, she calls him a man of comfort, whose advice hath often stilled my brawling discontent, to whom she is always bound. He has her go inside her home as Isabella approaches, and Claudio's sister tells the Fruc that she has set up the planned assignation with the deputy Duke Angelo. The Fruc hasn't broken the plan to Mariana yet. He calls her back out so Isabella can meet her. When she comes back, the Fruc asks her if she feels that he respects her, and when she says yes, he sends Mariana and Isabella off so that Claudio's sister can tell her the plan. After a quick six-line soliloquy by the Fruc, the maidens return, and all is agreed. The only request Isabella has for Mariana is a simple one. "Say, when you depart from him, but soft and low, remember now my brother." Of course, Angelo would expect a statement like this to come from Isabella. After all, this assignation is meant to save his life. But the irony is delicious. Remember that the reason Angelo had abandoned Mariana was because her dowry was lost when her brother was lost at sea. The Fruc ends the scene by assuring Mariana that what she's about to do is no sin, as Angelo is her husband on a pre-contract. Act 4, Scene 2 takes us back to the prison, where the provost asks Pompey the Clown, who is now an inmate, an unexpected question. Can you cut off a man's head? The prison's executioner lacks a helper, and with the impending executions of Claudio and Barnardine, this position needs to be filled. The provost is willing to cut a little time off of Pompey's sentence for state-sanctioned murderously good behavior. Pompey is willing, but he needs to receive some instruction. Enter the executioner, the wonderfully named Aborson. He is not exactly pleased to learn that his new assistant used to be a bawd, as he will discredit our mystery. There's some banter and wordplay between master and apprentice, and when all is agreed, the executing pair exits as the provost calls in the pair to be executed, and with apologies to the Thunderdome, two men leave, but only one man enters, Claudio. The provost shows Claudio the death warrant that calls for his execution by 8 tomorrow. Now, earlier in the play, Angelo had called for the execution to happen by 9. Now, I'm not sure if this change is to help a sense of plot acceleration or if it's an early sign that Angelo can't be trusted. But regardless, this can't be good. The provost asks where the second prisoner, Barnardine, is, and before leaving, Claudio informs him that the other prisoner is sleeping. The Fruc arrives and asks who called of late, obviously thinking that there's a message from Angelo calling off the execution coming momentarily, or maybe is already there. No note since curfew. The Fruc asks if Isabella has visited, again hopeful that she might deliver the news of the pardon herself. Again, no luck. The Fruc even hints that before morning they will hear good news from Claudio. As they speak, a messenger arrives with a note from Angelo. Both the Fruc and the provost think this is the pardon, but again, no such luck. Instead, the note moves up the execution to 4 o'clock in the morning and demands that the head of Claudio then be delivered to Angelo by 5. Any peril will be at the provost's peril. The Fruc doesn't freak out. He thinks. He asks about Barnardine and learns that he's been in prison for 9 years, is usually drunk, hasn't flinched when told he is to be executed, and hasn't left when given leave to escape. The Fruc then asks the provost to give Claudio 4 days' respite, and when the provost balks, noting the instructions, the Fruc has a plan. Chop off Barnardine's head and send that to Angelo. The Fruc promises that he will vouch for the provost, and beyond that, the Duke will too. Say what? The Fruc then shows the provost the letter with the Duke's seal. The Fruc says the letter tells of the return of the Duke. Moreover, he says that the Duke will return within 2 days, and that Angelo doesn't know this. All difficulties are but easy when they are known, he tells the provost. He then directs the provost to call the executioner and, After the Frook gives the prisoner advice on the next world, off with Barnadine's head. The third scene of the act is still in jail, as we get a witty opening soliloquy by Pompey, who discusses life as an executioner. A boorsun comes in and orders Barnadine to enter. When the prisoner finally does enter, after much refusal, he tells his executioners, "I have been drinking all night. I am not fitted for it." Even the arrival of the Frook does nothing to convince Barnadine that it's time to die. In fact, he leaves the Frook to go back to his cell. This is bad. Luckily, the provost returns with good news. There died this morning of a cruel fever one Ragozine, a most notorious pirate, a man of Claudio's years, his beard and head just of his color. The Frook calls it an accident that heaven provides, the very definition of a deus ex machina. He tells the provost to keep both Claudio and Barnadine in secret holds for 2 days, and the provost exits to do this. Alone, the Frook soliloquizes that he will write Angelo a letter that the provost will deliver, saying that the Duke is returning in 2 days, and that he wants to enter publicly and have a welcoming in front of the city gates. The provost returns with the head of the pirate, with which he exits to deliver to Angelo. Out goes the provost, and ahead, in comes Isabella, wanting to know about her brother's pardon. The Frook tells her of the execution. Of her brother. He doesn't tell her about his new plan to hide Claudio, but rather plays it off as the accelerated execution order had been, well, executed. He also tells her of the Duke's impending return and the plans for Angelo and Aeschylus to meet him at the gates, there to give up their power. He promises that if she can be there, then she'll get her desire on this wretch Angelo and the grace of the Duke. Furthermore, he gives her a letter to give to Friar Peter, directing him to get Isabella and Mariana to the Duke's welcoming. He apologizes, however, that he will be combined by a sacred vow and shall be absent. How convenient. Lucio arrives, commiserating with Isabella over her brother's death and delivering her news that the Duke returns tomorrow. News travels fast in Vienna, I guess. Concluding, if the old fantastical Duke of Dark Corners had been at home, Claudio would have lived. Isabella leaves, and before the Frook and Lucio do too, they exchange words regarding the absent Duke, with Lucio maintaining his slanders. At this point, the scenes in the act shorten, and the pace picks up. In Act 4, Scene 4, we see the reaction of Aeschylus and Angelo to the letters that have been sent by the Duke, letters that seem to contradict each other to the point that Angelo wonders if the Duke's actions show much like to madness. They also discuss the other direction they've received. If any crave redress of injustice, they should exhibit their petitions in the street. You can see where this is going, right? And so can Angelo, it seems, for as he is left alone on stage, he soliloquizes over his worries that Isabella will proclaim her maiden loss, as well as the guilt he feels for deflowering her and the regret of having Claudio executed. The combined irony here. Isabella's still a maiden, and Claudio still breathes, and his feelings of guilt and regret almost engender sympathy toward him. Almost, but not quite. The short Act 4, Scene 5 has the Duke, no longer the Frook, meeting with Friar Peter. He has explained his plot to Peter and confided in him that the provost knows the plot as well. In the almost as short final scene of the act, Isabella and Mariana speak of their roles in the plot. Isabella says that she feels that it should be Mariana who accuses Angelo, but since she trusts the Frook, she will go along with the plan. And there's not much else to say as Friar Peter comes in to take them to the welcoming party outside the city gates. The dominoes are in place, waiting for the one and only scene in Act 5, and as that fifth and final act of Measure for Measure begins, we're reaching the culmination of the plan of the Frook, or at least Plan B. Since the bed trick between Angelo and Isabella slash Mariana did not produce the pardon of Claudio everyone had expected, the Frook is doubling down on Claudio's supposed execution, even denying his sister any relief that he is being held safely in a secret cell. Why does the Frook do this? It seems unnecessary, but we're about to find out otherwise. The scene opens with Angelo and Aeschylus greeting the Duke at the welcoming ceremony just outside the city gates. Cordial, respectful, polite are the hallmarks. Only because we know what's coming does the Duke's statement that Angelo's deserving or desert speaks loud ring somewhat ominously. Almost instantly, Isabella enters and petitions the Duke to hear her complaint and grant her justice, justice, justice. When the Duke says that Lord Angelo will give her justice, she responds by saying, "You bid me seek redemption of the devil." And Angelo tells the Duke that he questions her sanity and predicts she will speak most bitterly and strange. Isabella agrees that what she's about to say is strange and then accuses Angelo of being a murderer, an adulterous thief, a hypocrite, a virgin violator. The Duke takes the side of Angelo, asking that she be taken away because she speaks the infirmity of the sense. As she continues to argue her case, however, the Duke admits that her madness hath the oddest frame of sense, and one has to wonder how much of what the Duke is saying is for the benefit of the crowd that has gathered, setting them up to help bring Angelo down. When she begins to tell the details of her tale, Lucio, in attempt to buttress her claims, continually interrupts with statements of support. The Duke chastises him for it. When she reaches the claim of Angelo's demand of her chastity, the Duke calls this into doubt, citing Angelo's integrity, just as Angelo would have predicted. But the Duke takes it one step further, saying, "Next, it imports no reason that with such vehemency he should pursue faults proper to himself. If he had so offended, he would have weighed thy brother by himself and not cut him off." This continues to build the subliminal case in the minds of his in-scene audience, the crowd. The Duke demands who sent her to do this, and she responds that it was Friar Lodowick, a man Lucio claims he doesn't like because he spake against the Duke's grace. These kinds of interjections from Lucio continue throughout the scene, always prompting the Duke to order him to be quiet. The Duke demands that the friar be found and brought to him. Friar Peter vouches for Lodowick, calling him divine and holy, but questions the validity of his claims as they so vulgarly and personally accuse Angelo. Isabella is taken aside, guarded, and Mariana enters, veiled. And much like the last scene of All's Well That Ends Well, the bed tricks substitute's speech is filled with ambiguous and contradictory statements. She is not married, yet no maid nor widow. This prompts Lucio to offer that she might be a punk or prostitute, and the Duke reprimands him again for speaking out of turn. Then she reveals herself and names Angelo as both her husband and he who thinks he knows that he ne'er knew my body, but knows he thinks that he knows Isabel's. She also reveals what she did at Angelo's garden house in Isabel's imagined person. After another comic interjection by Lucio, Angelo admits that he knows Mariana and that he was once engaged to her, but that he broke off the engagement not only because of the dowry, but because her reputation was disvalued in levity, in other words, accusing her of being unchaste. He even goes so far as to beg from the Duke the ability to question not only the women, but he who sets them on. The Duke agrees, giving Angelo the power to punish them to his height of pleasure. And just before the Duke has to exit the scene, they send the provost to retrieve the friar. Convenient, right? As they wait for the friar and Isabella to be brought forth, Lucio continues his slanders of the absent friar. When the fruit arrives, he criticizes the absent Duke for allowing the accused deputy Duke to sit in judgment. Aeschylus attacks the friar for attacking the Duke, but the fruit responds that he's been watching what's been going on in Vienna, where corruption boil and bubble. Lucio continues his attack on the friar, claiming he himself spoke well of the Duke against the friar's slanders. The Duke denies this, and when he does, Lucio physically accosts him, accidentally revealing the Duke. After the Duke makes sure that Lucio sneaks not away, he asks Angelo if he has anything to say in his defense. Angelo doesn't, admits his guilt, and calls for his own trial to be his own confession, immediate sentence, and then sequent death. Angelo, upon questioning, admits of having been contracted to Mariana. The Duke sends them off to be married. The Duke tells Isabel that he could not save Claudio because of the swift celerity of his death. Again, this bringing up of a dead Claudio seems gratuitous, purposefully cruel. As Angelo and Mariana re-enter, married, the Duke tells Isabella that she should pardon Angelo for Mariana's sake, but then reminds her that Angelo betrayed not only the law, but Claudio, and because of this, the law cries out, "An Angelo for Claudio, death for death. Haste still pays haste, and leisure answers leisure. Like doth quit like, and measure still for measure." And before Isabella can voice any mercy, the Duke calls for Angelo to be sent off to execution. The Duke doesn't respond when Mariana pleads for mercy, saying only that she can use her inheritance from Angelo to buy her a better husband. Mariana then begs mercy from Isabella, and Isabella is touched. She tells the Duke that she pardons Angelo. And now we understand why the Duke cruelly allowed Isabella to believe that her brother was dead. For her to show true mercy, the kind that Angelo failed to show, she had to forgive Angelo before knowing that Claudio was still alive. It's a teachable moment. The Duke reminds all that Claudio was executed early because of the note from Angelo. The Duke has the provost bring in the remaining death row prisoners so that they may be pardoned. Out are trotted Barnardine and Claudio hooded. When the Duke reveals Claudio to Isabella, he says, "If he be like your brother, for his sake is he pardoned, and for your lovely sake, give me your hand and say you will be mine. He is my brother too." So the Duke hints at marriage, but there's no response. The Duke pardons Angelo, but Lucio doesn't get off so easily. For slandering a prince, Lucio is first sentenced to marry any prostitute he hath begot with child, and then whipped and hanged. As if inspired by Isabella's mercy, or perhaps in an attempt to impress her, the Duke then rethinks the punishment and orders the marriage without the death, though for Lucio, marrying a punk is pressing to death, whipping, and hanging. In the final speech, the Duke sends Claudio off to marriage, reiterates Angelo's marriage, and again hints at a marriage for himself and Isabella. "Dear Isabel, I have a motion which imports your good, whereto if you a willing ear incline, what's mine is yours, and what yours is mine." But again, there's no acknowledgement nor agreement, and the play simply ends with his promise to reveal what's yet behind to all back at the palace. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries the last couple of weeks, you've missed out on subjects including All's Well That Ends Well, Pivot Point, All's Well That Ends Well, Wrap Up, Greetings from Ashland, New Month, New Play, Measure for Measure, Oregon Shakespeare Festival Pocket Reviews, Podcast 113, Theatrical Reviews, Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Pericles, Antony and Cleopatra, Much Ado About Nothing, Measure for Measure, Act 1 Plot Synopsis, Act 2 Plot Synopsis, the YouTube channel update for Measure for Measure, the Act 3 Plot Synopsis, Measure for Measure Sources, Act 4 Plot Synopsis, Measure for Measure Names, Act 5 Plot Synopsis, Theater Review Desdemona UCLA, and Theater Cinema Capture Review Hamlet at the Barbican. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. But remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for October the 18th, 2015. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.